Mr. Free, how we doing today?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I'm glad to hear from you, Coach.
Well, it's been a long time, but you know, me and you, we got a special place in each other's heart.
Yeah, that's true. I remember you naming one of the awards after me at Capitol Hill. Several years ago. And, of course, a lot of people don't understand those kind of things, but. Well, but you had some foresight.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, as we move on in life, we cherish those moments that we take for granted.
Sure we do. Especially now, I have plenty of time to sit here. You have a chance to explore your life and your experiences, and it's been great.
Now, let's talk about Ken Free. Let's talk about you and where baseball started for you.
Well, baseball started. My parents were from Greensboro, North Carolina, but moved to Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, when I was 4 months old. And so I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania from 1936 to 1948, when my dad felt that the steel mills were striking and going on, and decided to move back to Greensboro. Mm-hmm. But while I was in it, Harrisburg, it was a very, you know, Harrisburg was integrated, so sports was very popular. Mm-hmm. And living in public housing, many of the kids played on these integrated junior and high school teams and all. But baseball was always my sport because my dad had played it, and the Negro Leagues were very popular mm-hmm. in Harrisburg and all, and he took me to games.
Okay.
As a young boy, Island Park in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, kept Negro League, because Harrisburg had a Negro League team. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of it, but I used to love to watch when the Baltimore Eli Giants and the New York Black Yankees, and then every now and then Kansas City would come through, Monarchs, Birmingham Black Barons, and I remember all those teams that I used to try to walk like them, my dad said. I'd see them try to do whatever I watched them do in the park, on the sidelines. I'd try to imitate. Mm-hmm. But then I became a very good player on our playground back in the community. Mm-hmm. And we had a park there. So baseball became very much something that I lived. So I learned to play by myself during the day by throwing the ball off the building mm-hmm. in the projects there, public housing, at this brick wall. It was, and I would throw the ball off of it. And I learned how to play every position and knew how to throw that tennis ball at different spots on that wall. Mm-hmm. To learn how to get different kind of heights, how to short hop the ball, how to throw it high and run back and get it. And I learned, but baseball was always in my mind. Mm-hmm. And of course, softball and that type of thing. So when we moved back to North Carolina, baseball was very popular in those rural cities. Every community had a baseball team, mm-hmm. and we played every Saturday and Sunday. And I guess that's the same way it was in your part of the country, in New York and all of that. Mm-hmm. But then a great traveling semi-pro team in Greensboro, and I joined it at 15 years old, bunch of old guys and whatever. Mm-hmm. But we would go and come back at night, travel. On the weekend but we had to be back. Some guys would go to work and that type of thing. So then, I went to college and left a scholarship at North Carolina A&T State to go, because a scout wanted me to work out with the Pittsburgh Pirates in 55. And so I left the college and went there. And so it was very interesting that when I got cut, because they didn't have many places for black players to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you didn't get one of the northern minor league spots, you had limited opportunities on the minor leagues that in the South, because in many cities, you couldn't play on the same field with white players.
And that's why a lot of guys, it was a blessing that we had the Negro League, because a lot of those guys that didn't make it in organized ball got a chance to play in the Negro League.
Mm-hmm. So I ended up going in the service and playing three sports in the service. But when I got out in 1959, the Negro League was still struggling to stay alive, because, you know, this is post-Jackie Robinson, in which many of your players in Negro Leagues were fading. But we used the Negro League in 59 to barnstorm and all, in hopes of trying to be scouted with one of the major league clubs. So that went on, and I traveled around. That's when I had my big thrill by playing in the last Negro League East-West All-Star game in Comiskey Park. I played in that in 1959.
And then, you know, you guys played before some big crowds back in those days, 20,000, 30,000 people.
That's the reason that Branch Rickey went and got Jackie Robinson, see? Because what was happening, Rube Foster was a genius. He went to, during the time that started, you know, in 1919, that's when they had the race riots in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Those black soldiers come back from World War II, they pushed them up, and then they formed the Negro League in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
In 1924, Negro League Baseball was the third largest black business in the country. It was Atlanta Life, North Carolina Mutual Insurance, Madam C.J. Walsh of Negro League Baseball in 1924, they drew over 400,000 fans.
Mm.
You see, and in New York, they were drawing 40,000-50,000 people. In Brooklyn, the Dodgers were drawing like 13,000-12,000.
And then, baseball was still in my heart. I still wanted to get signed. And then, of course, the next year, the Brooklyn Cuban Giants came through, and we had Satchel Paige, who was trying to get back into baseball to get his fifth year of eligibility for a full pension.
Mm-hmm.
So he was staying in shape. So here's a guy still pitching, and I saw him when I was 10 and 11 years old in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, pitching in his heyday. Mm-hmm. Before 1948 when he came up. So it was just a thrill. Baseball was still good to me. But in that May, the Major League Baseball, Branch Rickey, who brought up Jackie Robinson, tried to get a third league, a third named the Continental League. And he had that proposal in the Congress. So the Western Carolina was created because it was going to be a farm team of the Continental League, because many of the teams in Buffalo and Toronto and different places were going to be major league teams of the Continental League. So the Congress did not approve it, and so did not approve the Continental League, but decided that they would expand the National League and American League. So my contract was picked up by the New York Mets from the Western Carolina League, and they had the Houston Colts as the other team. And then American League had the California Angels and a new Washington Senator team, since that team moved to Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to hook up in that league, but I worked out with a team called Lexington in that league, and the guy wanted to keep me, but the city told him he couldn't have but two blacks on the team, and he already had one, and he was going to sign this pitcher that came with me, so that gave him two blacks.
You know, teams, they had a quota system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if blacks, they don't have so many blacks on the team.
Yeah.
They have three or four, two of them don't be pitchers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have four, three or four on regular.
But it was just my fortune that the team they were playing that night was from Hickory. And he went over and asked the Hickory, he said, "Man, did you watch that kid work out?" I said, "I'd like to sign him, but the city won't let me have but two blacks on the team." And the guy said, "Send him over to Hickory. I can have four blacks." And that's how I hooked up into organized ball in New York Mets. But my career, you know, went on from that. I stayed in the Mets organization 4 years after that. But it was just interesting how the Negro Leagues had taught me how to play the game, how to play positions, how to play multiple positions. And in the Negro League, I remember how those guys used to do in the South. Of course, we didn't have nowhere to stay, so we'd travel on the bus at night.
When you went to the hotel, they couldn't stay at the hotels with the regular team. They had to carry the black players across town.
So what was that experience like?
Huh?
What was that experience like?
Well, with us, we stayed in some shabby hotels, some places, but in some of the hotels we stayed in were clean. But the hotels at that time they had television in the lobby, and in your room you had a basin, a pitcher in the basin, and a little towel. Now, hotels would have about 10 rooms on each floor.
Mm-hmm.
You got two to your room, and you got two bathrooms.
And we had gotten to, from Birmingham, after playing the Black Barons, we left going to Perth Amboy, New York, to play a team out up there, not a Negro League team, but a black team that was semi-pro, that was real good. And we were tired traveling all night because that's a long haul. And I remember the managers saying to us after eating those nabs and bologna sandwiches, and he would say, "Oh, I know you guys are tired, and I know how you feel, but we got to go out here and play because I'm told there's going to be five scouts in the stand. The Yankees, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, we're going to have five scouts in the stand. So you guys want to get out of the Negro League? This is your chance. Every night we play, but there's going to be scouts in the stand." Man, we spurk up just like we lived it, ward off a story, and play the game. And that team beat us that night, and as we were gathering after our shower and all, asked the general manager of our team, or booking secretary, I think they call him, and he said, we asked him, "Man, what? I know the scouts were there, but did they say anything? Did they see anybody they liked? What did the scouts say?" He said, "Oh, man, y'all played so bad. Them scouts left in the third inning." And, man, there wasn't no scouts there at all. but they used it to spurk us up. And, you know, the few Negro League teams that were still left in 59, it was like a traveling farm team. You going to get scouted every night, and you know how farm teams are to supply the major leagues. So we go from city to city, and we play all over the place. And that's the year we played. That was 59, the year we played all the way to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But even if that was the last Negro League All-Star game, it was because it still, according to the numbers that they gave us, it went from 60,000 people that they used to draw. But even at that game, we had 42,000 at Comiskey Park.
Wow.
And that was what was reported to us, which was, even now, that would be a heck of a crowd.
Yeah.
But it was just interesting. It was interesting to, I even remember the hotels that the two teams stayed in. There was a hotel called the Strand, and there was one called Wentworth. And all them good eating places and things that in Chicago. And I won't forget that experience. I don't think ever. And but you learn a lot of stuff. Even those 4 weeks I traveled with Satchel Paige, I learned so much from just sitting around talking and listening to him.
Satchel lasts a long time. What Satchel would do, Satchel back in six, I went on and Satchel took a group of guys and went to Canada.
Uh-huh.
I know a friend of mine, Larry LeGrand, that played with him. He was a catcher.
Mm-hmm.
And Satchel be riding along, had his fishing rod in the trunk of the car, in a cooler, the fifth of whiskey. And he'd see a lake, like up in Canada, and he thought to just go over here and see what he started fishing. And the promoter be waiting on him to show up. So sometimes Satchel show up about the fourth inning. Sometimes be the seventh inning before he show up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So Satchel was his old man.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, was he a down-earth person? Was he arrogant? Was he humble?
Yeah, he was down. He liked young ball players, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was just so interesting. And during that time, we had our own, couldn't go to the majors for Jackie Robinson, but we had our own, had good crowds, had good players, Josh Gibson and those, and Oscar Charleston, some of the great players in Negro League Baseball. Piper Davis, I remember my dad taking me to see in Pennsylvania, the Baltimore Eli Giants played somebody in Harrisburg, and Roy Campanella was the second string catcher to this guy named Clark. And then Campanella, of course, after Jackie Robinson, ended up in the big leagues.
Because just like Robinson, they sent him to Montreal. Played now Larry Doby,
mm-hmm.
Hank Thompson, Willis Brown. They didn't send them to the minors. They put them right in the majors, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. See, Hank Thompson and Willis Brown, they played with the Monarchs, and they were with the St. Louis Browns.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know.
But yeah, I played in the Negro League. I played a lot of baseball. Played in the minors. Didn't call up. Didn't get called up, so I ended up back, going back to school, finishing my education. And then, of course, I went on to a good profession. And position of notoriety was being the first full-time commissioner of the Mid-Eastern Athletic Conference, better known as MEAC, and those kind of things. And of course, on the March Madness, I was the first member of the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Committee. I was the first black on that. And I made them aware of the fact that with all the black players in college basketball, there should be a black member on that committee. But it wasn't about race so much as it was about you had to be an administrator to be on the basketball committee. You couldn't be active in coaching and that type of thing. So it was just a coincidence that I nominated another black guy to be the first black on that committee. And after they explored the thing, they decided that I should be the first. And it kind of threw me back to Negro League Baseball when Jackie Robinson was named to be the first black for Major League Baseball. There were a lot of players that may have been more deserving as far as ability is concerned. But maybe my social skills caused me to be the first. And when I say social skills, I'm talking about fitting into their social lives, like playing golf and the things that I was exposed to. And so that kind of thing. And then, of course, I know that guys that knew Josh Gibson and told me that Josh had worried him that he was not picked because he was supposed to be the best player at that time, even though some people think Oscar Charleston was the best player in Negro baseball. But Josh didn't like it. But France Rickey and them, as they do so well, is they do research and background checks, and they know good and well if they'd have brought up Josh Gibson with his background. And the first time he heard one of them call him an N-word, he'd be in jail because he'd crack somebody's neck. And then they had to convince Pee Wee Reese told me, I met Pee Wee Reese in Louisville when I was on the basketball committee trying to get, they were trying to get a Final Four, and I was on the inspection committee. And I sat with him at a luncheon, and I got to talk to him about Jackie Robinson and all. And he told me, he said, there wasn't no more tenacious baseball player in the world. I said, well, I noticed in Dodger Town that, you know, whatever the owner was at that time bought Dodger Town so that his so his black players didn't have to deal with racism in Vero Beach. He bought this Air Force base, and he said, I said, well, you taught Jackie Robinson how to play golf. He said, man, you didn't teach Jackie Robinson how to do nothing. All you had to do was take him out there and show him what the game was. Jackie Robinson taught his, he said he was good at everything. I mean, he just picked it up himself and made himself that kind of player. So he was tenacious and that type of guy. I got Pee Wee Reese's autograph on my dad because he was a Dodger fan because he went to the World Series every year after 47 with Jackie Robinson and no Spade. So to get Pee Wee Reese's autograph in that late date because he was on the local committee in Louisville.
Well, what position did you play?
I started off as a shortstop and ended up third baseman. I played third in the Negro League. And there was an old Negro, you can look this up, an old Negro League player, outstanding third baseman, that they said that I played like, his last name was Danridge. Because he had, well, I was bow-legged, he was bow-legged. I had a long head, and he had a long head. But Danridge was out of Richmond, Virginia, and a hell of a Negro League player. So I ended up a third baseman most of my career. And I played, when I played in Mets organization, I had to play shortstop a lot of times. And then when school was out, they'd always sign someone at shortstop and I'd go back to third. And then one made the major leagues and played one of my teammates was Bud Harrelson, who played with the Mets that beat Baltimore in 69. And of course, Tug McGraw, he and his brother played with. So Hank and McGraw's. And so third base was my major position. But in Negro League ball, a lot of times you had to play other positions. So I even caught. Mm-hmm. I played second base. In the Mets organization, I even played first base, outfield. But I learned that from throwing that tennis ball off that wall in the public housing projects in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. 15 years old, I started playing with older guys in these traveling local semi-pro teams. And we would travel all over. Like the team I played for was the Greensboro Redbirds. Mm-hmm. And they traveled and played. Like I played against, with the Redbirds, I played against Hank Aaron when he was with the Clowns. Mm-hmm. He was second baseman at the time. But that was good baseball. And it was like a farm team because mm-hmm. every time we played a Negro League team, the Greensboro Redbirds, one of our players would end up leaving with one of those teams. And one of the guys just died who played at A&T and played with the Redbirds, and the Memphis Red Sox came through and we played, and he left with them, Jimmy Robinson. Mm-hmm. You may have saw him on the Toyota commercials before he died. And he was a teammate of ours on Greensboro, you know, coming out of A&T right here. He played with that team until Memphis signed him. So he was an old Negro League player. But every time we'd play one of them teams, they'd take one of our players. Because during that time, after Jackie Robinson, man, them guys at the Negro League team, they had contracts on you. Mm-hmm. And for a Major League team to sign you, they had to buy the contract. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, one of our Negro League players, it didn't get signed until late. And somebody asked him why he wasn't signed sooner. And he said, because the general manager on his team, I think it might have been with the Monarchs. But anyway, he said that, the Chicago American Giants, let me see. Well, one of them, he said, his manager kept him back. He didn't know it. Was asking for too much money for him. Mm. And the Major League Club did not want to pay that much for him. So he never knew that. Mm-hmm. But the Negro League team that had his contract wasn't going to give him up for that price. So a lot of times, you know, we didn't know what the cost was to those teams, but those guys had investments mm-hmm. in us, and they weren't giving us away.
Yeah.
So and you can't blame them.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, you know, I might have been a superstar with them, but Major League club said, no, I ain't gonna give you no $20,000 for him. Yeah. 15 or whatever. There were several players picked up from that East-West game mm-hmm. that went on and played in the Major League.
Because, you know, in the early days, Negro League baseball played under like 5 years for the majors.
Mm. And mind
it. And if you read back, the Negro League teams played Major League teams years ago, and what they would do, they would beat the major league teams. But what they would do, they make the Negro League teams play on a like an all-star team.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't say that Kansas City Monarchs beat the New York Yankees, you know.
Well, what was the pay like in Negro Leagues? How did y'all, how was y'all paid?
Okay, we were paid monthly, so to speak. But let me tell you, that's a good question you had. My salary for the Raleigh Tigers had bought a franchise in the Negro Leagues later on, and they paid me $150 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I got it. Yeah. Whenever they got around to it.
Is that called Robert Peter to pay Paul? That's what we call it today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, see, the rule was we got $2 a night. They call it eating money.
Okay, meal money.
Yeah. Okay, so $2 a day is what you got plus your salary. Now, you get paid every night after the game. And I learned how to eat, save enough money to wash my clothes, because it took a dime and to wash and two dimes to dry. Mm. So we would take 30 cents and set it aside whenever you wanted to wash your clothes traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the 70 cents, or whatever's left of the $2 out of 30 cents,
mm-hmm.
then you would eat. And most of those meals back then was big meals. It sold restaurants, man.
Mm-hmm.
45 cents.
Mm.
During that time, you got them black restaurants give you two pieces of meat and three vegetables. I mean, mm-hmm. you ate good. And then, of course, you save something for breakfast. Now, what I learned to do was to sleep to 10, 11 o'clock when we got to New York and we were playing around New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed at the Harlem Y, and you left every day around 2 o'clock to get to the site where you're going to play around New Jersey for a night game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would give me a bowl of cereal, and my dad told me to keep me some prune juice.
Mm-hmm.
He said you stay alert with your bowels moving. So you get you some prune juice and a bowl of cereal. And then for lunch, on your way out, you get a big slice of pizza,
uh-huh.
15-cent slice of pizza.
Uh-huh.
I think those things cost $5 now.
Yeah, close to it.
Yeah, but out of New York, there was best pizza sold on the street you ever seen.
Mm.
So we'd get that. Then we'd get another $2 after the game of that night.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have your good evening meal, 12 o'clock at night, 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and you eat a good meal.
So we went to bus stop in a place called Lawrenceville.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, you go in the bus stop, you go in the restaurant. Blacks couldn't go in the restaurant. They had a little hole where you could the dishwasher your money.
Uh-huh.
So they got 15 in the rest stop. So by the time they feed all the white people, 15 minutes start loading back on the bus. Now you got a chance. I can stay there and miss the bus. I lose my money.
Uh-huh.
Need no money back.
But the pay was, during that time, was not, your contract may be filled based on what kind of crowds
mm-hmm.
you drew back then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, baseball had become so diluted in these towns that the crowds sometimes would cause you to get a half a paycheck
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff. So you struggle, but the exposure and things that you went through was just good. But it wasn't nothing like the days when Jackie Robinson and them played. Because see, when Jackie came out of college, he, you know, he was a three or four letter man out of UCLA. And I mean, these, and people would come see these guys play. And so they made good money back in those days. But I don't think those monthly contracts were anything absorbent. But I know that my contract was $150 in 1959. And I think the top salary was like $300 a month.
And how long was the season back then? Did it go from...
Well, the season started... See, a lot of guys in the Negro League, and it lasted up until, I guess it folded, but way back then, most of those guys come out of Florida and working at hotels and resort areas during the winter. They start spring training because it was warm. And come Easter, the Negro League was playing. Mm. I mean, we were playing in the end of March. And so, I mean, them teams come through Harrisburg early, going wherever they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular year that I played, we opened up in Newark. And that was end of March. And on Easter, man, we had double hitters somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you ended around Labor Day.
Okay, September.
Yeah, September, the first Monday in September. That was a big payday for Negro League Baseball.
Okay. That
Monday. And so that was a big payday. But see, what concerns me now is that when, even with the Negro National Anthem, I asked, I've had young black kids ask me, Negro National Anthem? Negro League? What was that? I mean, somehow or another our history has been taken away. And yeah. I mean, these kids hadn't learned anything about, what did we need a Negro National Anthem for?
I mean, what about this new generation of ball players, and more importantly, African American ball players that's coming up that don't know nothing about their generation of ball players?
Well, I don't really blame the generation or blame the, you know, like Bob Marley says, you don't blame the children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I blame, the parents, baseball, and a generation before them for not passing along the history to them.
Mm-hmm. Major League Baseball and black ball players kind of bear some of the blame for not catching that torch on.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's why I blame the most. You know, not the torch necessarily, but the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, hey man, look up this guy, because we're in a state. We're in a generation of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So hey, the information's there. We just have to direct them, to the information.
Son, you were, because you could stand up to the white folks' national anthem.
Yeah.
Or you couldn't play in the major leagues because of your color. And that's why we had to start our own league, the Negro League.
Yeah.
That was our major league. So, I mean, so I can admire what you're doing, because now you're talking about layers of parents that came along after these things occurred, and nobody told them about it. And see, then we were so sometimes jealous of each other's history of back when it was all black that we don't talk about it. We don't tell about it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is the most, I had the most concern about what I've done because a couple of articles have come out about me when this Major League accepted the statistics from the Negro League.
Mm-hmm.
They asked me my comments and all that.
Just last week, Major League Baseball honored the Negro League players at Rick Wood. What was your thoughts about that?
I thought it was great. You know, it was you know, obviously it was kind of coincided with the passing of Willie Mays, who is a friend of mine. And, you know, honoring the Negro League players at Rick Wood in Birmingham, Alabama, but also to see, you know, people of color from all walks of life, you know, from basketball, celebrities that are musicians and artists, and it just seemed like everyone was just really enjoying themselves and, you know, giving a nod to the Negro Leagues. And I thought baseball got it right. You know, I think there was even an inning where it was in black and white. And so that was pretty cool. I was playing, coaching, so I didn't get a chance to see the footage or the coverage, but I heard that they did a great job, and, you know, hats off to Major League Baseball.
And just like you said, a lot of people say, Ken, I've been around these people a long time, and they say, Ken, I didn't know you played in England, blah, blah, blah. Well, I guess it's my fault that I didn't tell anybody. But when I told people about the Negro League, you might get a little laugh, a little or something like that, but never no question about what it was like or whatever. Now, whatever I went through, it was a luxury for the old Negro League player. Mm-hmm. If you watch the pitchers, out of uniform pitchers, man, they'll catch it. Dressed up with nice clothes and hats.
Mm-hmm.
It was sharp. You know what I mean? Big time. Negro League baseball players. And, it was like, you know, the days of Sugar Ray and Joe Louis and that kind of stuff.
What was the price to go to a game?
Oh, man. I think that Daddy would pay 25 cents.
Wow. Not today.
Not today. But I mean, now I remember one time going to see the Kansas City Monarchs against the House of David. That was 75 cents for adults and 50 cents for kids. That was top dollar then.
Wow.
And then, of course, things started going up like they are.
And then I hear they had, y'all had a thing with the food out there. They barbecued and sold fish dinners, chicken dinners, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. And a jar of white liquor, too.
See, us city boys like me, we don't know nothing about no white liquor now.
Oh, man. They call it corn.
Uh-oh.
Whatever. But it was bootleg stuff. Uh-huh. The guys sell it. But I hate I mentioned that, but that was...
It's part of the history. We got to know it now.
Oh yeah, man! You had the fish and chicken, and we used to raise money with another vegetable, another meat called chitlins.
Yeah,
they'd have a chitlin strut, and it's a dollar a plate and stuff like that, and good old potato salad. And pinto bean and collard green. And boy, you talking about selling. And you could, I mean, everybody ate, man.
Was the cooks?
Huh?
Who was the cooks?
Oh, man, they'd have their wives and a little organization, pretty much like you see now. Okay. And then if you had a restaurant that knew how to cook in the field. But see, you had those concession stands with stoves and stuff in it, man. And them cooks and them women get back there and come out with them meals, man. But you had to stand in line like you do now. I mean, that kind of thing. And so you had outside the arena back in Negro League Baseball with people selling stuff outside, their specialties.
Yeah.
And you come up to the gate and all around the stadium, man, you got people with their own, like you done sold booths.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of that food came from. And that before you get in there to them hot dogs and stuff like that.
Oh, Lord.
that was an afterthought, them hot dog stuff. And then people started getting upset that sold popcorn and hot dogs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They got rid of those people who charged them so much for a spot to cook their own food and meal. But you would always had food and that kind of selling that around Negro League Baseball.
What was the travel like in those days?
Okay, the travel was bad. Not bad. but travel below the Mason-Dixon line, and you were glad whenever you went above the other line.
Mm-hmm.
Travel was on a bus. Everybody had a big bus, like one of them old Greyhounds.
Mm-hmm.
They call them flexibles.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have bathrooms on them, but most of our travel was at night after a game.
Uh-huh.
So you could pull on the side of the road and use the bathroom.
Yeah.
So travel was at night. You make sure while we playing that bus driver go and fill the bus up and have it ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get his sleep while we playing ball. And then you go and you during the South, you make sure you're gassed up. And if you stop to get something, you had to be very careful because at night, them places that were owned by white people wouldn't let you come in there as a gang. You come in there in pairs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And with no hotels available to you.
Mm-hmm.
In some cities, they had these tourist homes and that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, in most of your good towns, you finish your game and you got to go somewhere. But you would go eat, and you had these soul or black restaurants and stuff that stayed open to about 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so you made sure you didn't leave there until that place closed. And so, based on where you had to go,
mm-hmm.
and so we would do that. Now, every now and then, when you had to play in the same area, you find one of those tourist homes or YMCAs or somewhere to spend the night.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, you travel all night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because the manager would come down and see who's pitching, where his pitchers were going to pitch the next night and all.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't, they wouldn't let them, if they were a right-hand pitcher, you couldn't sit next to the window on the right side. If you're a left-hand pitcher, you couldn't sit next to the window on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
You sit in the aisle or over on the right side,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want you to catch cold in your arm and that type of thing. So they would nurse you like that.
Yeah.
And it was interesting.
Uh-huh.
But during that time, a lot of times though, there'd be a lot of arguments between pitchers. And if you made an error back then, if you're a young player, man, you might get slapped.
Uh-oh.
One of them pitchers tell you. But travel was good. You didn't travel in no uniform or nothing. You never looked like a ball player on the bus while you were traveling.
Yeah.
I mean, they were very sharp. You walked into the stadium, and that's the first time people knew you was a ball player. You didn't wear no cap, no baseball cap. And everything was in a bag, and you had on dress clothes all the time. You always looked the best when you went to a stadium. Nice shirt, pair of slacks, that type of stuff.
Now, do you have any of your Negro League uniforms?
No, I don't. I got one that I made up with Raleigh on it and the Raleigh cap, but it's not original.
So who kept those? The owners?
Yeah. Yeah. They kept them, pass them out every year. Mm-hmm. No, you didn't keep them. And a lot of times you got them cleaned as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And passed back out, that type of thing. But you turn those uniforms in, that kind of stuff. And then, see, during that time, you never thought about it being valuable. Like, I should have took all kind of pictures because I couldn't afford a camera.
Yeah.
Which actually pays those 4 months that I traveled with him.
Uh-huh.
You know, because nowadays, you know, you got to show a picture or something for someone to believe that you did it.
Yeah.
So I hate I didn't take, you know, more pictures, but a camera and traveling, you know, sometimes back then you had to put your film in and it'd take a week to get it back.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of stuff where you carry it with you until you got somewhere where you're going to be there long enough to have it develop.
Yeah.
But they had the best thing going for Negro baseball was the type of black papers and the reporters that we had back then.
Mm.
Those Afro, the Journeyman Guide. And I guess there's a big, it was a big paper out of Chicago, a black paper.
Mm-hmm.
And those writers and stuff kept up with Negro League Baseball, just like the other papers did the other. So, man, you got your picture in the Journal Guide. Them guys were something else back in those days. And you need to do a history of those writers.
Mm-hmm.
Black Negro League sports or black sports in general.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were outstanding.
Mm.
Blow it up, make it look good. I forget some of those guys' names. I was talking about them the other day, a guy called me, but there was several Hall of Fame black sports writers in those black papers back then. They were big time. And the New York, Chicago, Baltimore, those cities had all these writers, and they were outstanding. That's some history.
Satchel Paige, what was he like, and what was your relationship with him?
Okay, Satchel Paige was an old guy when I met with him, but our relationship was he was always like a star.
Mm-hmm.
But he was congenial and helpful. You know, the contract was he pitched wherever we played. If it was every night, he'd pitch two innings.
Okay.
That was his commitment. Mm-hmm. So people would get a chance to see him and that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he was basically staying in shape to get that fifth year of Major League pension.
Mm-hmm.
1 year, and he's hoping. And then several years after I played with him, 2 or 3 years later, if you remember, the Atlanta Braves picked him up, and he got his fifth year. Ted Turner picked him up for the Atlanta Braves, and Satchel got it. He drove me. Huh?
What was he like? Was he quiet? Was he funny? Was he outgoing?
Yeah, well, he was about 6'1", outgoing. If he would drive his car, he would not ride no bus or nothing with anybody, because the word was, when he got tired or if he didn't like what was going on, he'd leave you.
Mm.
He'd just leave you like that. But he was a good man, and he would always tell his son, if you're going to make it, if you're going to get signed, you need to do this, you need to do that. But he was a very polished interview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And type of thing. But we feared him.
Mm-hmm.
You know how we were, and being young.
Yeah.
And I'd ask him, did he remember playing in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania? He said, oh yeah, I remember Harrisburg. But he was just a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had that that star air about him. Yeah. After being in the majors, so much publicity and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I had the privilege of we had guys that had to leave after a game to get back to work in their hometowns, and I left to have to catch him. And we were playing the Philadelphia Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I'm warming him up in the bullpen, and I'm in a squat, but he loved to talk, and you could hear him talk all over the stadium. And people would be on the fence and ask him a question. And between pitches, he'd explaining what they're asking, and I'm sitting down there squatting. And you have to stand up. Get back down there, he'd say. Man, my legs are hurting. You ain't constantly pitching. And then he was the type of guy that didn't believe in all these pitches. You know, he said, you can have five pitches, but if you can't get them over the plate, it ain't worth a damn, he'd say.
Yeah.
And he would always, he would take care of his body.
Mm-hmm.
He'd drink a glass of water, but he'd put a spoonful of sugar in it. And that was it.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
But he was a nice man, well-dressed,
mm-hmm.
at all time, and always some good philosophy for you.
Mm. History says that Jackie Robinson was the first to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball. Now, there's also rumors that Moses Fleetwood Walker was actually the first black player in baseball. Did the Negro Leagues have any history of Moses Fleetwood Walker?
They have some, but I don't. They have some of Fleetwood Walker, but...
I guess I'm asking, do the Negro League players acknowledge him as being the first, or was he the first?
No, I don't remember him being... Now, you had some guys playing on some teams back in the day, but some guys have an organization, because I was honored in it, me and Sam Allen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a good question for Sam.
History has recorded Jackie Robinson as the first black player in the major leagues. Now, I heard a story, and I had to ask Mr. Free about it. He told me I had to ask you, are you familiar with Moses Fleetwood?
Fleetwood Walker, yeah, and the brother named Weldy Walker. Played with the Toledo Blue Sox.
Now, was he actually the first black player in the major leagues?
Yes, what they say, I think 6 or 7 years later, Jackie Robinson said this. What they say is Jackie was the first of modern time. Yeah, Moses Fleetwood Walker. And he had a brother named Weldy Walker that played.
Okay. So should we rewrite the history books, or should we leave it as it is?
Well, we need to. I mean, I consider Moses Fleetwood Walker, you know.
Because a lot of people never heard of that name.
Plus, you know, a lot of people don't know that in 1947, you had five blacks ending up in the majors.
No, I didn't know that either.
You got to, at some point in time, give consideration to hanging it up. Mm-hmm. When you look at the decline of African-American players in the game, yourself, when you guys leave out, there's no African-Americans coming behind you. There's no Daryl Strawberries. There's no Griffey Jr.'s coming. All the brothers in the game are the stars of the game.
You know what? You try to stay away from stuff like that. I've been called a lot of names because I've been outspoken about that. A lot of the players around, especially African-American players around the league, are actually, you know, we're out there trying to push for it and really give back and get these kids interested. It all boils down, follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's no money there, there's no financial backing,
mm-hmm.
You won't see an increase nowhere.
I played 14 years in the big leagues, but more significant than that to me is that I spent 8.5 years in the minor leagues,
mm-hmm.
and still made it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually after about 4 years in the minors, if you haven't made it, they release you. Or the young player gets discouraged and he quits.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up in the 50s where I couldn't stay where my teammates stayed. I couldn't I couldn't eat where they ate, and I couldn't even travel the way they traveled. I had to do it separately. But I had this great dream, all based on the fact that Jackie Robinson was playing in a town called Brooklyn for a team by the name of the Dodgers. And so my childhood dream was to play for the Dodgers. And I realized that. And in those 8.5 years in the minors, struggling and going through stuff like I just mentioned, nothing could take away from that dream. And I hung in there, and I eventually made it.
We go honor your legacy.
Well, I appreciate that.
We go honor your legacy. When you gone well beyond, they going to be talking about Ken Free.
Well, I'll be done. Well, I'll be done. Well, I hope so. My two boys would love that, and my grandkids.
Well, we're going to leave your legacy behind, Mr. Free. You got my word on that. We're going to leave your legacy.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
It's going to be.
Okay. I appreciate it here.